Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and I am joined today by Lainey Newman, who is the author, along with Theda Scotchpole, of Rust Belt Union Blues, Why Working Class Voters Are Turning Away from the Democratic Party, new from Columbia University Press. Lainey, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Stephen. I'm excited to be here.
So before we talk about the book itself, I wonder if you might tell folks just a little bit about you and who you are and what brought you to this project.
Yeah, definitely. So I am a native of Pittsburgh. I graduated from Harvard College in 2021. My senior thesis when I was at Harvard was about sort of the evolution of union members' political loyalties in Western Pennsylvania, where I'm from. I have family members who were United Auto Workers in the Minneapolis region and have always sort of been interested in the alignment between unions and Democrats and sort of what that represents and really where it's gone over the past several decades. And so I did this project as a under the advisement of Professor Scotchpole. And when it concluded that year, she and some other faculty members were really excited about it and wanted to sort of continue, see if we could do some more, continue the project on. And so we partnered for the following year and decided to turn it into a broader project looking at sort of the Rust Belt in general and how we could sort of expand these themes to encompass a larger population. And currently I'm a second year law student. I'm at Harvard Law School. And I'm hoping to end up doing workers' protection work or class actions, plaintiff side class action work. But we will definitely see where that goes. So
excellent. The way you lay out the book is sort of what is it that used to be, what's happened, and what's to come. So why don't we sort of go in that order? If you would sort of talk what it. Historically, as you hinted, right, there has been this strong correlation between political identity, voting behavior, and union membership. Can you, just before we try to explain that, talk about what used to be and what's changed over time and how would we describe the current moment by contrast?
Yeah, sure. So I think we start the book by looking at what historically was this conception and this identity of the quote unquote union man, and I think that term, whenever I say that to people, I think that really rings a bell. It resonates with a lot of Americans. There's a conception of what the union man was. I think that it's a term that is sort of is well known in even today. But what we do is we sort of interrogate what that term really meant in the context of union loyalty and political affiliation. And so we start by trying to understand the social underpinnings of the union man. And what we mean by that is sort of what was important, what was important to these union members? What communities were they part of? And where did their sense of union loyalty come from? And one of the things that we want to sort of push against in our argument is this idea that, union members used to listen to the official endorsements of their international union, and today they don't. Really, what we argue is the sort of the loyalty that workers used to have to their union, and by extension, really, to the Democratic Party, which they saw as, a mutual sort of alliance in terms of the political affiliation, wasn't based on sort of a top-down directive from union leadership. It was really based on a shared identity, a shared sort of sense of commitment and mutuality that was much more sort of grassroots than it was from the top leadership. And so we look at different things that sort of or different sort of concepts that the union man and the union members of this era, and when I'm say this era, the mid 20th century, that cemented that sort of identity in the community and amongst workers. And so we look at the historical awareness that a lot of union members had to what many saw as was a great, sort of the debt that they felt towards previous workers who had experienced really intense, even violence or strife in the face of worker oppression before unions were sort of there to protect workers. So there's historical awareness, there's mutual commitment between workers. So the idea that I've got you and you've got me, we're here, we support each other. When someone, is having a hard time, we're there to support them. And then there's the idea of occupational pride. So people really feeling connected to either their trade or their industry, and feeling a sense of identity that stems from what they do. And in the case of Western Pennsylvania, a lot of it was steel. And there was a lot of pride about being a steel worker. And again, intergenerational pride about being a steelworker, about being a coal miner, and in the trades, a lot of pride about what particular craft someone did, which often did follow generational lines as well, get passed down. So we looked at that identity, and sort of that was our starting place, and then we look at sort of what happened, and I think that this is where a lot of scholars have made arguments that the downfall of labor is sort of is just in line with resource capabilities, with union density, with these sort of metrics that we use to measure union strength. And what we say is those are definitely all part of it. But we also argue that as those factors emerge, and as sort of unions were declining, there was a retraction of the sort of social, the importance attributed to social community building within unions, and to the extent that unions were formerly really entrenched in communities and connected with other organizations, that also sort of was beginning to dissipate during this era of the decline of labor. So from the 70s through the 90s, essentially. And then to quickly, conclude on what you asked in terms of where we are today, I think that what we see today is people trying to figure out why workers who are members of unions in the industrial Midwest often don't support Democratic candidates. And I think that there's this sort of misconception, or at least Theda and I argue that there's a misconception that workers, quote unquote, vote against their best interest, and we want to push back on that, because we don't see the way we understand voting is that voting is based on a lot more than just an economic policy or a certain an objective, rational measure of what would be I'd be this much better off, I'd be that much better. Like that, it just isn't. We don't see voting as that. We see voting as very much laden with conceptions of identity and community, emotion, all of these things. And so we explain this in part because of changing social dynamics and where workers are getting a sense of community today. And we look at organizations, civic organizations that are still present in the industrial Midwest, two of which are local gun clubs, which have actually grown, have spread in ubiquity and also grown in membership over the past couple decades, and then also larger churches. And so we touch on that a little bit, but also, you know, the main research, we didn't have much time to get into the meat of those. So there's a lot more research that needs to be done. But that from what we could tell in our interviews, those were the two civic organizations that seem to be present today and obviously have a lot more conservative leanings, oftentimes than unions and fraternal groups and small labor oriented churches used to. So I'll leave it at now.
Great. So before we borrow in there, and that answer kind of anticipates my next question, I guess first thing I should say is your focus here is industrial and building trade unions that particularly in the earlier period were, when you talk about union man, you mean man, right? These were disproportionately white men.
Disproportionately, right. Correct.
Mm-hmm. So, but you sort of describe that milieu, the world that they inhabited. Why did that translate for them to so consistently be aligned with the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I think that what we argue is that these worker to worker connections sort of created a sense of identity around being a union man in the context of a union community. And there was an underlying understanding, I think, that unions were, or that Democrats were on the side of unions. And so to the extent, and what I was saying a little bit before about how it wasn't, we found some interesting survey data from the 50s about how United Steelworkers members were, that the survey showed that steelworkers didn't really appreciate when the union was telling them how to vote, and instead, you know, liked that there was information being provided, but really, it's always been the case that, and I think that this is true for any number of different population subsets in the country, but that, you know, people don't want to be told how to vote, but that really where this was coming from was this sort of understanding that Democrats were present in these communities, they were going to advocate for workers. There's some really interesting interview data, quotes that I have in there that from my retirees that basically were along the lines of, you know, Republicans had never done anything for the working man, and everyone just knew everyone just sort of understood that it was a sense of, you know, who's there for us, you know, and who we're going to show up for. And really what you see now in these regions is the absolute reverse. And that, you know, the group, the shared identity in a lot of these industrial or ex-industrial areas is that the Republicans are there for us and we're going to show up for them. And so I think that, you know, it's a little bit amorphous, I think, but I think that the worker to worker and within communities, the presence of the Democratic Party and, you know, sort of the sense that they're there and that they're the ones who advocate for working people was what drove the workers to vote for Democrats.
You also spend some time looking at the ways in which unions really were embedded throughout the community in any number of different institutions, thereby sort of increasing the power of that, whatever we want to call that, that viral, that networking, that sort of construction of the shared identity and community. Can you just, for folks who may not be familiar with that, talk about what did it used to look like to be a union member?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's something that we really focus on a lot, and I think really made a difference for people. So unions during this era were not only economic, you know, bargaining units, but they were involved in workers' lives in a lot of different ways, and involved in communities in a lot of different ways, and in family life in a lot of different ways. So, for example, we look at the steelworkers local up in Aliquippa, which is about an hour northwest of Pittsburgh, and that local was involved in, was connected to the local churches, would you know, sort of partner with them on certain charitable activities, hosted, you know, sort of trade, coin trading events, or, you know, collecting, you know, sort of people who are collectors of coins would have their events at the union halls. The union halls were places where people would go for, you know, fraternal organizations would have
literal physical spaces, right?
Right, exactly. Yes. So they were community institutions, brick and mortar institutions. There were dinners and events there. And you know, not only for the union, for hosted by the union, but that work hosts, you know, sort of affiliated with the union, you know, other community organizations that would use the space. The union would sponsor, you know, activities for children, so like a soapbox derby or something like that. You know, all of the leagues that we know from Robert Putnam's work. So like the unions had bowling leagues and softball leagues, and teams with that, and there would be sort of intra-union competitions of, you know, the people from one shop versus another, you know, in these different sports. The union also provided a lot of information to valuable information and sort of education to their members via a regular newsletter that would talk about, you know, not only union related issues, but also what family, you know, recent news amongst families, you know, new marriages and births and that type of thing, but also sort of educate people on different things that may be of interest to them. So, for example, a lot of members hunted, and that has always been the case, that members had guns and hunted, or many at least. And so there would be, you know, news about when hunting season was and what, you know, what was allowed and that type of thing. So readily available information for members that they found, you know, really useful and that was not only related to union activity, but was really related to people lives in general. And so, you know, in these different ways, the union was connected with a lot of different aspects of a person's self and a person's community, and in a way that sort of made unions permeate not only, you know, workers' professional lives, but their, you know, their lives overall. And I think that that had a lot more, you know, we argue that that had a lot more staying power. And in that way, unions were a lot more salient when voters, you know, we're sort of, again, as we say, like, you know, it's not, you know, voting is so much more than just, you know, checking the box or saying, you know, this measuring different metrics. But, you know, in the calculation, unions were really present and provided a lot of context for voters' lives and for voters' political sort of concerns. And so in that way, I think that, you know, the unions we see today in most cases are not as deeply involved in workers' lives, and there are definitely exceptions to that. Some unions that have done very well with staying involved in building community, but that is what we saw during this era: a lot of, you know, interrelation between workers, communities, and other institutions.
So we see a decline in the ways in which unions are embedded throughout various aspects of a union member's lives. And as that decline takes place, there comes with it a shift in voting behavior. So what happened? What causes the decline in that form of union engagement? And how does that then translate into different political identities?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, yeah, that's sort of the big question that we look at. And I think there's a couple different things that happened, of course, during this time. And so I'll start by saying, I think, you know, as the main thing that we look at is unions during this era provided a counterweight to a lot of other sort of political interests or, you know, concerns that workers may have had. And one of the things that we highlight is, you know, a lot of these workers have, or a lot, this population, you know, and we're mainly looking at white men during these years, have always had these sort of culturally conservative views. And so one of the things that I think was interesting in our research is that, you know, it wasn't so much as people, you know, this people in this generation in the '60s or whenever, not having, you know, certain sort of prejudicial, frankly, views on women or people of color, but really that the union provided a counterweight to all of those, to those types of concerns, and that workers felt really connected to the union in such a way that they prioritized their union membership and union loyalty over potentially other, you know, sort of messaging that was coming from different entities. So, you know, more conservative entities that were trying to, you know, bring workers over to that side. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we argue is that as unions have lost sort of their salience in members' lives, for, you know, for a lot of reasons, that counterweight has just sort of, you know, dissipated, sort of fell through. And so, it, you know, in its place has been just continuing, sort of hammering of these cultural and more conservative messaging and messages coming from certain groups or entities. And so and this goes along with what we were looking at with the civic organizations that are present in these communities, and how unions formerly were one of many civic organizations that included fraternal groups, local churches, gun clubs, you know, and then women's auxiliaries and all the like, but that today there's far fewer, you know, really strong, civic organizations. And this is a phenomenon that you know, Scotchpool and others have researched for a long time, but that there's just been a decline of civic organization and involvement. But some of the organizations that are still present are these ones that have conservative leanings. And so we found that, and this was simply by hearing interviewees, my interviewees talking about where, you know, where people would meet up. And you know, formerly I didn't know that gun clubs had a social element. I just had frankly assumed that it was, you know, I don't even know what I had assumed, but in doing more of this research, you realize, wow. So a lot of these gun clubs have, clubhouses, they have bingo nights, they have dinners, you know, they have these
work holiday parties.
Yeah. So they have, exactly. Holiday parties and even women's, sort of associations within the clubs. And so a lot of the, you know, that was a surprising thing that we found, that I think that, you know, and we don't know, you know, the extent to which that's, or how many workers are affected by that. But there is evidence in you know, in our interviews and in some of the supporting research that we've found, that a lot of workers, you know, are involved in that type of organization, an NRA affiliated gun club. And of course that has, you know, socializing and with that backdrop has very different implications than socializing with, you know, in a union hall or at a union sponsored softball event or something like that. And so that's sort of one of the changes that we note over time. And then another thing that I'll say is that I think that Democrats, this is something that we heard from a lot of our interviewees, but that Democrats have kind of quote unquote abandoned some of these communities. And so Democrats used to be, you know, very present and involved in a lot of these places. And I think that there has been a movement at the national level to sort of, you know, really focus on cities and particularly on the coasts to you know, for votes, and essentially show up only at election time, or even maybe not even at election time, because, you know, some of the campaigns didn't show up to these regions at election time, but, you know, just kind of bank on urban votes as opposed to really reaching out to some of these areas. And so I think that those two things, you know, sort of decline of unions involvement and providing that counterweight to conservative influences, and simultaneous to that, Democrats being sort of retracting from these areas and really focusing on urban areas has provided a lot of that swing that we see in the last couple decades.
And it, I mean, it's hard not to be thinking specifically of the kinds of appeals that Trump made, right, to the white Rust Belt in ways that you say that other Republicans and Democrats really hadn't in the last couple of days. And there are a number of the folks that you interview sort of talking about, he's listening to me, he's paying attention to me, right? Sort of really basic stuff. Again, hammering this idea that as any political scientist worth their salt will tell you, right? For most people, voting is not a rational calculus, right? It is not a lining up all the policies that the parties identify with and the things that matter most to me. It is much more sort of social in that regard. So if you've got someone paying attention to you and feel like you've been ignored, when your material well-being has absolutely been in decline, right?
Exactly.
It's, I think, really important to emphasize this. They're not hallucinating sort of worsened fortunes. Before, I want to get your thoughts on sort of where you think this goes, but I want to back up to one of the sort of interesting observations you made is, you know, during this period of decline, right, this is a period of globalization, this is a period of increasing attacks on unions, right, we go from more than a third of the workforce unionized to 10 or 11% today. This is also, in another context, what we describe as the decline of the male breadwinner model, right? This world in which a household with a spouse and children could have one worker earning enough to pay the bills, to pay the mortgage, to send the kids to school, and also, as you observe, freeing up time for that male breadwinner to be more engaged in the union. You talk about the ways in which these lead to emasculation and status resentment. Can you talk a little bit about what you see going on there?
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, and as you said, during this era, you know, and in part, you know, I think that the sort of nuclear family model played a huge role in workers' ability to engage in the union activities in the ways that they did during this era. So, you know, a lot of people talked about, and we saw a lot in the archival documents about, you know, workers socializing after work, you know, going to the bar together, that type of thing. And that was all made possible by the nuclear family model, you know, that dads didn't have to go and pick up their kids after work. And something that we've noticed, and that actually a lot of our, sort of middle-aged, interviewees commented on, is the change that has happened, you know, that now dads are, and men are a lot more involved in, you know, the immediate family life and in engaging with daily, child rearing responsibilities. And in that way, you know, I think that organizing, you know, for some of these workers, you know, social activities or events, and even, you know, meetings after work, for union meetings after work, or sort of, you know, getting together at the bar, is a different calculus today than it once was. And I guess I will say, so I think that one of the things that we think is a opening there is that unions, even during this era, were, you know, even despite the sort of male breadwinner model, were highly involved in family life. And women were very involved via auxiliaries or, you know, supporting their husbands and you know, packing the lunches and that type of thing. And women were paid attention to in the sense that, you know, there were, in the magazines or, the union magazines or the newsletters, there was always a section about, you know, for the women. And some of them are quite interesting actually about, you know, how appreciative women ought to be about the, you know, their families and whatnot, and providing suggestions on recipes and that type of thing. But, you know, I think that unions involvement in families, obviously today is not going to look the same, but there is still opportunity to really engage with the family as a whole. And that's something that I think that, you know, unions, it doesn't can be difficult for unions in the sense that, you know, maybe they're not able to get workers to meet immediately after work or go to the bar or whatever. But I think that in terms of organizing and community building, engaging with the family as a whole, maybe, you know, even more successful today in some respects because of, you know, the increased male involvement in family life. So that's one thing. And then what you were talking about regarding emasculation. So I think that a lot of, and this feeds into sort of what you were saying previously about the status shifts and the Trump was paying attention to these folks and sort of, you know, even, you know, playing to these resentments. So what we saw is when these manufacturing jobs started to decline, women went to work. Right. And so women were, you know, women were making money and were, becoming co-equal breadwinners in the family. And it was really interesting. One of my interviewees said, you know, he was an older interviewee, and he said, you know, so what happens is that the dad is, you know, bumming around trying to find a job, and the mom goes to work and the kids don't get a good upbringing because she's out working and you know, they're not with their mom anymore. And I think that was, that was said in with a lot of genuine, you know, concern. I think that during this era, that was the understanding that, women were supposed to be raising children, and that was sort of the right way to have a family. And that when that changed, there was a lot of insecurity felt by people about that shift. And so I'll just end by saying that, one of the things that we look at with the involvement in these gun organizations is the sense that, you know, sort of regaining guns as a way to sort of assert power. And there's been a lot of really great research done by a couple, Matthew Lacombe and a couple other researchers, about what, you know, guns really represent to gun owners. And I think that plays into this sense of, wanting to sort of push against the status threat that these working, the economic shifts have sort of engendered. And that, you know, guns and these clubs play on, quote unquote, like, you know, male protective instincts and that type of thing. But the emasculation of this era, I think, did feed into sort of a sense of resentment over, you know, the changes that were happening and the broader cultural changes that were happening, not only the immediate sort of social changes in the community as well.
So to bring us to a conclusion, Lainey, so if you were to be offering advice to the Democrats who wanted to regain some of their support among this particular population, what would you tell them? Or is it a lost cause and they're Republican for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, well, I would definitely not want to tell them that it's a lost cause. But, so I think that Democrats need to understand that this should be a long game, right? That investing in these communities is a long game. It's not enough to just show up at election time or get out the vote and expect people to quote unquote vote for their best economic interests, because that's just not what it's, you know, that's just not a realistic understanding of why people vote, of how people vote.
And how is that new bridge helping me? Thank you very much. When the price of food seems too high.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I think that Democrats need to understand that they need to be present in these communities, and involved in communities, throughout the years, through, you know, and not only leading up to elections. And to so in a lot of these areas, first I'll say that, you know, Democrats have sort of just retreated completely almost because of, you know, the margins that Republicans run up and the feeling that this will never change. But, you know, what I think that is important is in 2020, Biden lost by less in all of these counties, as opposed to in 2016, you know, the margins were less, right? And so I think that the idea that, you know, we shouldn't show up because it's a lost cause is really misaligned, because, you know, even the margins matter in these states that are swing states. And so that's the first thing I'll say. And then the second thing I'll say
before you go on, can I ask the cynical question?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
How much of Biden's overperformance of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama is that he was neither female nor black?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is definitely an element of that. I think that it's hard to disentangle, but Biden did show up in a way that Hillary didn't. So Biden went to a lot of these places around, at least in Western Pennsylvania. I think that was a lesson learned from the 2016 campaign. But I also think that Biden sort of slated himself as, you know, he said, you know, Union Joe or whatever the phrase was. You know, he was a union guy that are supportive of unions, and he has been. And I think that those things do matter. And you know, they're not gonna necessarily sway all the people who were voting for Trump and the steelworkers, but they matter. They matter in the sense that there are going to be some who show up and vote, who didn't vote last time. Even those things do, I think, make a difference. I think that it is. It's hard to disentangle race and gender, but some of the things that the Biden campaign did, like showing up to these places and, you know, the styling and branding of and you know, promises, I guess, that the Biden campaign made about to support unions, I think, were consequential in a certain respect.
So you're going to make a second observation before I interrupted you.
Yeah. So then the second observation that I would just make is that, you know, I think that Democrats in trying to, you know, be present in these areas, you know, not only during election time, should try to sort of lateral into or try to understand the community, the community organization, sort of how the community is organized and what institutions are present, and how to sort of lateral into those institutions and get involved in those institutions where people are engaging with one another, where there's events happening, the places where people, you know, meet up, whether it's, you know, YMCAs or the churches or what have you, to the extent that those places still exist. I think that it's important for, you know, there to be a continuing sort of presence of, okay, well, you know, Democrats are here. Democrats, you know, it's surprising to me even that having like a brick and mortar, you know, physical location, one of the Republican county chair people I talked to told me about how she just, you know, people would drop by the brick and, you know, the Republican county party, like the physical location, and just sort of hang out there. And I mean, I think that type of thing is interesting, but it is true that people sort of get together in different places. And I think the Democrats need to understand where people are getting together, how people are getting together, and sort of how the party can support different things in the community, if that makes sense. So to me, I think, you know, Democrats need to have a sort of broader understanding of how to organize, you know, not only during election time, and then not only in a political sense, but in a community building sense as well.
You're listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking today with Lainey Newman, who is the co-author with Theda Scotchpohl of Rust Belt Union Blues, Why Working Class Voters Are Turning Away from the Democratic Party, new from Columbia University Press. Lainey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Stephen. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.